Again, that's Bodie Phelps' Angelversary and Protest on Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at Gresham City Hall, 1333 Northwest Eastman Parkway in Gresham. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. Since its original publication in 1961, Catch-22 by Joseph Heller has become a classic of anti-war literature, gaining fame during the Vietnam War for its dark and satirical look at American military life. Filmed to middling results by Mike Nichols in 1970, a new miniseries on Hulu has brought the novel back into the spotlight, where its focus on circular reasoning and insanity seems apropos to life during the current American regime. Catch-22 was Joseph Heller's first novel. In the 1970s, he wrote the novels Something Happened and Good as Gold, and in the 80s, God Knows and Picture This, and the nonfiction No Laughing Matter about his struggle with Guillain-Barré syndrome. In 1994, Joseph Heller came out with a sequel to Catch-22, titled Closing Time, which deals with what happened to the lead character Yossarian and other characters after the end of World War II. Richard A. Lupoff and I had a chance to chat with Joseph Heller on October 17, 1994, about Closing Time, Catch-22, and other aspects of his career. This interview has not been heard since 2000, when it aired following the death of Joseph Heller at the age of 76.
World War II was, I guess, the formative event of your generation. Vietnam was the formative event of mine. I don't know what is the formative event of the generation after mine. Can you comment a little about how you think those different events affected each of the generations and where that ties in with the apocalyptic vision of Closing Time?
It would be hard for me to do it without going away and organizing my thoughts. Differences were these. I can give you the differences. World War II, after Pearl Harbor, it was a war that had the approval of almost the entire population. And it was the only war in the history of this country about which that could be said. And after World War II, there was a feeling of triumph, and we had an expanding economy, or we seemed to have. I don't know where all the money came from, even to fight the war, and I mentioned that point in Closing Time. On Monday, one-third of the country was ill-housed, ill-fed, and ill-clothed, and then on Thursday, we were producing Liberty ships and Boeing bombers and the rest. After World War II, there was a GI Bill of Rights. I benefited from it. Yossarian benefited. Several million Americans benefited. We went to college, which most of us never thought we would do. We went to college with the expectation that when we came out of college, there'd be a job waiting for us that we would like to do, work we wanted to do. And for most of us, that turned out to be true. Vietnam was a different thing entirely. It was a war to which the country stole. There was never given a basis for our involvement in it that was convincing to the population. Again, we did not get into the war until after Pearl Harbor. And on that same Sunday, Hitler declared war on the U.S. before Congress met on Monday. Vietnam, we were in the war without knowing we were in it. It was done secretly. It was done over objections. It was never popular with the population, and there was no good reason given for having fought it. And when the war was over, the economy was not particularly good. The servicemen, I doubt they had pride. I find this to be true. The literature I've read on the Vietnam War is the best war writing I've ever experienced. The nonfiction, Michael Hare's Dispatches, Philip Caputo's A Rumor of War, the novel by Tim O'Brien and Gustav Horsberg. It's the most gripping war literature I've ever read. And one reason is Kurt Vonnegut gave it to me when I told him. He says, that's the literature was written by people who were in combat, whereas he and I, we were marginally in combat. He was shelled and he was taken prisoner, was in Dresden. I was overseas as a bombardier at a time when missions were very easy for my bomb group. The Vietnam War was horrible and horrifying, and we were given descriptions of it. And when the veterans came out of the war, I don't know what they had to look forward to or what they had to be proud of. I think the Vietnam War gave us a good reason to be suspicious of our government in the way that I was in Catch-22, but by implication. In Catch-22, the biggest threat comes not so much from the Germans in combat, the biggest threat to sanity, security, to the servicemen, comes from their own superior officers, their private ambitions, which have their analogs in political ambitions, their inefficiency, their incompetence, their lack of sensitivity to their responsibilities. I think by the time of the Vietnam War, that was now evident. There was no good reason after the Vietnam War ever to trust a statement from anybody in government again. And at the end of Closing Time, one of the lines I like, when they're on the ground and a man named Dr. Strangelove is in charge, he's making his announcements, and he says, since all the bulletins you receive will come from official sources, there's no reason to believe any of them, so we're not going to issue any.
Another element that relates Catch-22 to Closing Time is the Catch-22 itself, the catch, and the Freedom of Information Act of modern days.
Yeah, well, the one I use in Closing Time, one of those I use is the Freedom of Information Act. It is a piece of legislation which obliges government agencies to release all the information they have on a person who requests it, except the information they have that they don't want to release. That comes up in Closing Time, so there's no way of knowing whether the Freedom of Information Act is being obeyed or not.
It seems to me that the person Richard Nixon is almost a fictional character out of Catch-22. When you were following his career, did you see the absurdity in that at all?
He was an absurd man from the beginning, long before he became president, when he was Eisenhower's vice president. The absurdity is that a man like him can't achieve the White House, or a man like any of the presidents we've had, I would say, since Eisenhower. Eisenhower had stature. I preferred Adlai Stevenson to him, but in office there was a certain presence he had as a chief executive. Along with the character of my book, Sam Singer and his wife and Lou Rabinowitz, I've had not much respect for any president since, and I don't see why I should have, and I don't see why anybody else should have, except those who hope to profit by having an ally in office.
In Closing Time, there are a number of references to the sitting president at the time when the book takes place, which is itself not quite clear to me whether it's 1994 or 1984, which in itself I wonder if that is a subliminal or covert reference. But also, to me, it seems as if Dan Quayle is president.
The president has certain attributes of Dan Quayle. In the original version of Closing Time, which started years and years back, George Bush was president, Dan Quayle was his vice president, and I had one or two chapters, very funny, extensive chapters, dealing with Bush's resigning and Quayle taking office and the whole country pleading with Bush not to resign because Quayle would take office. But by the time the book was finished, number one, Bush was out of office, and number two, it was out of proportion. It was a funny chapter, but it was slowing down the forward movement of my novel even more than other things were slowing down. What you do have in Closing Time is this. You do have a presence who's nothing vicious about him. He's rather simple-minded. And through being simple-minded and careless, he produces an action which may lead to the apocalypse and the end of the world. It may not lead to the end of the world. But it's not done through anything psychopathic. It's just done through pure simple-mindedness and playfulness, which I think is how we got into the Vietnam War. I think it's how we got into the Gulf War. There are no real reasons ever given that were convincing that were justified. He does have the character as Dan Quayle. He is from Indiana, and he insists that Missouri, the home state of Mark Twain, is a neighboring state. And he does have a fundamentalist Christian belief in that he believes in every detail of the flood. And he thinks evolution is a lot of bunk.
You mentioned this deleted chapter from Closing Time, and I've also been aware that early in your career you wrote short stories and a number of other pieces which I don't believe are part of any of your books. Would we ever be able to get our hands on a collected miscellanea of Joseph Heller?
Not while I'm alive. They're accessible. The short stories and the early pieces were given to the Brandeis Library, and people who do books on Joseph Heller, and there have been five or six, and there's another one in progress, they do describe and do make reference to them. They're not particularly good. They were written when I was very young. The ones that were published are available. Stories were published in Esquire and the Atlantic Monthly. I was very youthful. They were derivative. They were imitations of Hemingway and John O'Hara and Irwin Shore. And they're available if anybody wants to do the research. They're not valuable as literature. The nonfiction pieces were humorous. The only way I can write nonfiction if it's a reminiscence about my experience, and I can make it funny, or I can make it serious, as in No Laughing Matter, which was about my experience with Guillain-Barré. I'm no good at nonfiction, and I was skillful. Youth, precociously skillful at short story writing while I was an undergraduate. So I was able to produce short stories that were accepted for publication. But then I pretty much stopped writing by the time I left college, because I realized these stories were not much. They weren't saying much. They weren't doing anything new. And I stopped writing until I decided about 30 years old. I stopped writing, I'm talking about a three-year period. I may have produced a short story or two in that period. But and then at the age of 30, back in New York City, after teaching in Pennsylvania, I thought I could write a novel. Maybe I was mature enough. And the novel that came to me was Catch 22.
What was the relationship of your real-life experiences in the war with the experiences of Yossarian and Milo and all the other characters in Catch 22?
Only in the matter of factual detail did they correspond with my experience. I was a bombardier. I was stationed in Corsica, which is the island of Pianosa. I did fly missions over the targets that were described in Catch 22. The organization of the squadron and the bomb group came from my own experience. The fact that there's a flight surgeon, that there's a group chaplain, that each squadron had a commanding officer, that we went to Restley's in Rome and had a fantastically wonderful time. If for someone like myself who's always loved to eat and it was just discovering sex, it was like paradise, except I didn't have to die to get there. I did not experience the turmoil that Yossarian did. I did not experience the superior officers of nature he did. I never had trouble with a superior officer. There was never any question about the efficiency. And late in Catch 22, Yossarian, when he's having a debate in the hospital, says we were a damn good squadron. We worked pretty well, and I flew my mission. So even his, he takes a little bit of pride in his work. But what motivates Yossarian and informs the book is not my experience in the war, but my experiences after the war, when I was educated, when I was reading newspapers, when I was thinking critically, and had a good view of what American political life was like and economic life was like. Catch 22 was published in the 60s, it was popular in the 60s, but it was a novel that was shaped in the 50s by the Korean War, by the McCarthy hearings, by the racial unrest and attempt to find solutions, and by the Cold War. The fact that even under Eisenhower, we had a Secretary of State who was boasting that he would carry the country to the brink of war, and the threat of another atomic war with Russia, and the war, almost threatening war with China all the time, over Formosa, over two islands, Matsu and Kimoi, I think. What frightens me now as I recall this is it was quite possible that we could have gone to war with China over those two islands that nobody even thinks about anymore.
You're listening to an October 1994 interview with the late Joseph Heller, author of Catch-22 and its sequel, Closing Time. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Was the book really called Catch-18 at one time?
Yes, it was called Catch-18. The first chapter was published in New World Writing No. 7 in 1955 as Catch-18. The number had no significance to me, 18. It was changed because the same season as Catch-22 was finally finishing coming out, a better-known author, Leon Uris, was going to publish called Mila 18, and it was unlikely that book buyers or book reviewers would want to deal with two books with the number 18 in the title. So after a great deal of soul-searching and agonizing, at my editor's suggestion, he said, why don't I call it Catch-22? And I said, my God, that's it. I could say that 22 is more appropriate because it reflects certain patterns of structure in the novel, but that's not why it's a good title. It's a good title because the book was the book began to mean a lot to more and more people.
Were there any earlier attempts at novels, fragments or failed attempts before Catch-22?
I would say no, but recently, well, a year or two ago, an archivist at the Air Force Academy, he went into the whole history of pre-publication history of Catch-22 and the first year of publication. And he has found correspondence in libraries, which indicates that I had started a novel. I was corresponding with an editor who published one of my short stories. My memory of that is very, very dim, and it goes back long before I thought I could do a novel. It goes back to maybe 1946 or 47. I have no idea how far I got with it or what. I do not regard that as a serious attempt.
I recall hearing an interview or reading an interview around the time of the publication of Something Happened, where someone asked you why it took so long between books, and you said, well, I started a number of books, but never quite got into them. Do those fragments exist?
No, no. I doubt I said that, and if it was published that way, then I was not quoted accurately. I did not start another book before Something Happened. I think Something Happened was started maybe 8 months after Catch-22 came out, and when I had time to think again, and that has been my pattern ever since. I publish a novel, takes a year or so after publication when I go about giving interviews like this, which I enjoy very, very much, I enjoy doing very much. Something Happened took so long because I had to work full-time at teaching in order to support a wife and two children. Catch-22 is probably the least profitable of my novels. Now, over the 30-year period, if somebody wanted to take the trouble to calculate the income, it was probably significant, substantial. It did not produce much money for me until 1970 or 71, when the motion picture came out and caused a tremendous sale in the paperback in a concentrated period. But 1971, I was almost finished with the novel.
I remember at the time my wife and I went to see a double bill of Catch-22 and Slaughterhouse-5. Did you ever think of those two in tandem?
I didn't see the movie of Slaughterhouse-5. I saw Catch-22 only because I was connected. By that time, I stopped going to movies very regularly. I can't see a connection between them, other than the same moral attitude and the fact that Kurt and I have our own literary personalities. They're individual. Our sentiments tend to be the same. I don't think our books are at all alike. In Slaughterhouse-5, I would say a third or more of the book has to do with fantasy figures. My fantasy figures are kind of spring from the symbolic or the subconscious.
Comparisons to Slaughterhouse-5 have to creep up in reading Closing Time because of your description of the firebombing of Dresden.
Vonnegut describes being a prisoner in Slaughterhouse-5, and he does it in one of the speeches he makes. If that's what you're referring to, yes, recollections of it are intended to come up. So that Lou Rabinow is in talking, and Lou Rabinow doesn't read books, but his family tells him this guy Vonnegut wrote a book about the experience, which he has not read. To that extent, it is intended to recall Vonnegut and to recall Slaughterhouse-5 and the other writing that Vonnegut has done about being a POW And Vonnegut was consulted on this. I sent him the pages of the experience of being in the Battle of the Bulge, being in the unit that was surrendered in total. I showed him those pages. He gave me information. He corrected a number of details that I had.
As I was reading Closing Time, particularly in the early chapters, and later on I think it broadens, but in the early chapters, there were two very distinct tones in the book, almost as if I was reading two separate novels with alternating chapters. One was the satirical, comical fantasy life of Yossarian and his relationship with his old buddies from Catch-22, and the other was the very serious and very almost hyper-realistic lives of Sammy Singer and Lou Rabinowitz. How deliberate was that juxtaposition?
That was deliberate. It was intentional. And I often thought in doing it I might have a problem because these are two different novels. There's also a third voice. About every four or five chapters, you have an omniscient narrator talking about Yossarian and Sammy Singer in the third person. But Sam Singer and Lou Rabinowitz are stories told only in the first person. Yossarian is only in the third person. The spirit of comedy in each is different. The literary approach is different. With Sam Singer and Lou Rabinowitz, I was doing something I'd never done before, which is to deal with characters in some depth in a realistic way. And in a sympathetic way. I've never done that in any of my novels, even in God Knows, where King David is telling a very emotional story. He departs from this period to use my idioms, and he uses anachronism, whereas Lou Rabinowitz and Sam Singer's stories are told to be believed. With the conventional objective of conventional fiction, the reader is supposed to believe that what they say is true and what happens to them actually did happen. Whereas with Yossarian, I think from the very beginning, we are still in a somewhat manic, not so realistic wouldn't be the word, I don't have the word, non-realistic way, and the type of comedy that comes up in Yossarian's story is very often the type of comedy that's in Catch-22. That was intentional, and the plan was to ultimately not merge the literary styles, because the difference in literary styles persists even to the final pages, but to bring them together and to have what would be a plausible conversation. So when Yossarian and Sammy Singer meet again, neither thinks much of what the other has been doing in the years in between.
But in a sense, they recognize themselves as the same person.
They recognize themselves as the same person, to the extent that they each have accommodated themselves to the social and economic surroundings in which they live, and it was necessary to do that in order to survive. And in order to do that, it also means they have to repress or suppress ideals and the idealism they have as young men. And I think one of the significant lines in that part of the book is when, you know, Sarian says to Sammy, "Sammy, if we're not careful, we grow up to be the kind of people we pretended to despise when young."
You also occasionally, every 100 pages or so, have a short chapter about a man named George Tillieu, whose house in Coney Island has sunk down to hell, or the lower depths of
not quite to hell, and whose Steeplechase Amusement Park has disappeared also. That begins with a factual basis. The Steeplechase Park was in Coney Island well past World War II. George C. Tillieu did have a house across the street with his name on the first stone of a stoop, and that stone was sinking. The house is gone now, and Steeplechase Park is gone now. In Closing Time, four levels below the bus terminal, Mr. George C. Tillieu, who had been dead almost 80 years, sat at his roll-top desk counting his money and felt himself sitting on top of the world. So I give you George C. Tillieu and Steeplechase as an afterlife. It's not hell. Although he is in touch with Satan and Lucifer, he's on a level far above them, and he has a Steeplechase Park, and people drift in. Other characters in the book drift in. Other characters from our past drift in, like J.P. Morgan, and we do have a few characters from Catch-22 who were killed in Catch-22, Kid Samson and McWatt. It's very calm, it's very complacent, and it's eternal. he thinks, except at the end of the book when his house is sinking again, and when you get them the third time, this is after the president has pressed the button, Rockefeller Center comes crashing in from above, and he laughs because he recalls the old phrase, nothing new under the sun, and he said he had just learned something new, even hell is not forever.
One of the wonderful things I think about writing novels is that unlike a gymnast who peaks at age 12 or an Olympic swimmer who peaks at age 16, a novelist can just keep going and growing and learning. You mentioned some new things that you have done in closing time that you had never done before. Still, by the themes of the book and by the very title of the book, I wonder, do you regard this as a valedictory to your career?
I don't regard it as a valedictory to my career. I do regard Closing Time as a novel that encompasses the most in the way of thematic material and even psychological material and subconscious material and spiritual material of any of my novels. I haven't begun to think about it yet, but occasionally the thought flits across my mind that I doubt my next novel will be as large as Closing Time, and if it is as large, I might not be alive to finish it. There is that valedictory feeling to Closing Time, stemming from the title, stemming from the ending of the book, Yossarian's optimistically going out from a safe bomb shelter to keep a date with a woman who's bearing his child, and the feeling of maybe everything's going to be all right for all three of them. Contrast with Sammy Singer, now we're back to the realistic approach. Who knows he's 71, who is, his wife has died, and he's on an airplane going to visit an old friend, and he's listening to one of his favorite symphonies of mine, which is Mahler's Fifth, and he's reading a collection of 7 or 8 short stories by Thomas Mann, which has been mentioned in the book before, which contains the story Death in Venice, while the moon is turning red.
How important are these relationships between men and women that keep recurring in Closing Time and in all of your books?
The real relation between men and women, the only ones I've really presented are in Closing Time, where the most meaningful relationships and the ideal condition has been one of marriage that Sam Singer has enjoyed, marrying a 28, a Gentile girl with 3 children, and Lou Rabinowitz marrying a Jewish girl, and both of them remaining married for their lives, nurturing children, seeing what happens to them. And it's one of the few American novels in which marriage is presented as an ideal condition, and women are presented without a mocking approach. Certainly is true in my novels. I've never dealt with women before as real people. I've never dealt with marriage as a subject. Happy marriages, satisfying marriages are not the subjects of plays or movies or novels, but they are, to a large extent, the subject of Closing Time.
And do you feel that this reflects a change in Joseph Heller or a change in American society?
I think it reflects neither. I think it reflects a change in Joseph Heller's novels. I don't think my attitude toward anything has changed in the 30 or 40 years I've been a writer, except the attitude toward the novel. And the attitude toward the novel is both reverential, adventurous, challenging. And in this novel, I'm trying something different. You're familiar with all my novels, all means 5 or 6. They are, to a large extent, different from each other. If they're similar, it's only because they come from the same literary personality, which is mine.
Despite respectful reviews and reputation, Closing Time is mostly forgotten today, though it is easily available online in both paper and ebook. The film of Catch-22 is available streaming through Amazon Prime subscription, and the miniseries is available streaming on Hulu. Joseph Heller published a memoir, Now and Then, in 1998, and another novel, Portrait of the Artist as an Old Man, an autobiographical work about an author who was unable to shake the success of his very first novel. It was published posthumously in 2000. You've been listening to an interview recorded October 17th, 1994, with the late Joseph Heller, author of Catch-22 and its sequel, Closing Time. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. The complete interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next, it's Words and Pictures, featuring conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle. Every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Counser, and today we're talking about animation and community with artists from Oregon, California, and overseas, as well as a couple of festival founders. Marilyn Zornado is in the studio. She is producing a night of poetry and animation in honor of the 200th birthday of poet Walt Whitman. And she's joined by Ben Pop. Ben is the programmer for the Northwest Film Center, where the event Whitman at the Witzel is taking place. And just to make things interesting, we're also joined by two festival impresarios. Our good friend Sven Bonnickson is with us to talk about the last big hurrah of the Northwest Animation Festival. And Einar Baldwin will be on the phone talking about the Glass Animation Festival. That's coming up. But first, we'll get a chance to talk with Einar and Sven. But Walt Whitman, Marilyn, you've assembled quite the lineup of Northwest animators to pay tribute to the great American poet of the 19th